This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I don't want millions, mister.
Tom Rush.
I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Won't you give me back my job again?
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Rush, a brilliant musician, a good friend, a good man, incredible guy, actually. Back in 1978, Louise and I started a community for abused kids in New Hampshire. It's still there and still running, the New England-Salem Children's Village. And Tom Rush came out and did benefits for us and all kinds of stuff. Anyhow, if you like his music, he's incredible. So, Sandra Day O'Connor has left the Supreme Court. Sandra Day O'Connor has resigned. Sandra Day O'Connor, the swing vote when it comes to abortion, the swing vote when it comes to the death penalty, the swing vote when it comes to affirmative action. And it's going to be, I guarantee you, in the press, watch this, in the mainstream media, you're going to see this argument framed about who's going to be replacing her as the religious right against the secular left. That's how they're going to frame this thing, because they like, you know, nice little black and white cartoons. But what's really going to be going on is that big business is going to tell George W. Bush who to put into that position. And it will be somebody who isn't a fanatic about abortion, but is conservative. And then Bush will say, see, I did pick a centrist. And everybody's going to applaud him and say, hooray, hooray. He didn't take a position in the right versus left thing. He's a uniter, not a divider. But it'll really be somebody who is on the side of big business. And just, I mean, take this right from the Wall Street Journal. I shared this story with you a few days ago. Here it is. This from the front page of the Wall Street Journal. They're talking about the National Association of Manufacturers, which represents big corporations. This is quoting the Wall Street Journal. Is creating a committee of executives to screen the business rulings of prospective nominees. Two lower court judges have drawn interest in corporate circles because they represented companies on regulatory matters before going on the federal bench. John Roberts of the Washington, D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals and Michael McConnell of the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver. So those are the names to watch, my friends. Big business, which wants to avoid regulatory scrutiny, is saying, go with John Roberts or Michael McConnell. And big business doesn't care what their positions are on abortion. They just want to know that these are guys who, if they're on the Supreme Court, will say, big business has the right to tell you that you can't tell them what they can do in your neighborhood. And I guarantee you, this administration has been 100% corporate all along. They talk about abortion and gay marriage and all that kind of stuff when elections come around, but it's just lip service. What they're really about is helping those with inherited wealth and multinational corporations gain and increase their wealth and their political power. And they'll do the same thing with this court nomination. You just mark my words. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Have a great weekend. We'll be back here on Monday. See you then.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here along with Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie, you know you're doing good radio when the program directors of a particular radio station call up and want to talk to your guests. This is Tom with KGOE Radio in Eureka, California. He runs the station. He has a question for you.
Tom. Hey, it's a pleasure to be on the air with you, Bernie, and you, Tom. I do have a question. I've been reading that both versions of the energy bill, the House and the Senate, contain a provision to eliminate the Public Utilities Holding Company Act, signed into law by FDR.
The House bill certainly does, and that is an absolute disaster, which sets us up for Enron-type processes.
Well, yeah, and I read that they were talking about giving FERC a little more oversight over it. Aren't those are the people that oversaw California getting ripped off the billions of dollars?
Absolutely. No, I mean, the bill that was passed in the House is beyond comprehension. It is a total giveaway to the corporate energy sector, and we've got to stop it.
I agree.
Tom, thanks for the call, and thanks for keeping us on the air.
All right.
I appreciate it.
I want to mention one thing before we go off the air.
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
It's July 4th, and there's going to be a lot of parades and celebrations. The way this administration that constantly tells us how much they love our troops have been treating veterans is an absolute national disgrace. And some people may have been reading recently that, in fact, even right now, as we speak, the Veterans Administration does not have the money today to take adequate care of our veterans, not to mention what's going to be happening when thousands and thousands of veterans come back from Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
They have fought us tooth and nail when we wanted to appropriate reasonable sums of money for the VA. Last night they were embarrassed, and they had to, in the House at least, allow for $975 million, not enough to be passed. But I would hope that listeners will stand up for veterans and make sure that those people who fought in World War II or Korea or Vietnam or wherever, and those certainly younger people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, have the health care and the other benefits to which they are entitled.
Well said, Bernie. We have about 20 seconds. Tam and Sammamish.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm very, very happy to be speaking, particularly to Mr. Sanders. I have a question about the state of the Democratic Party, and I realize that you're an independent.
We're out of time, Tam. I'm sorry. That's gonna. I have a feeling, Bernie, it's gonna take you longer.
All right. Save that for next week, Tam.
There you go. Yeah.
Okay,
Tam, give us a shout back next week. Congressman Bernie Sanders. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Good to be with you.
I do appreciate it. It is always so great to have you on this program. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank, not the RNC, not the Daily Memo from Roger Ailes. No, it's truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends.
You can get it if you really want.
Yeah, we've got to work to get political change in the United States. Get active. Get out there. Start participating like Congressman Bernie Sanders does. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, our telephone number, toll-free across the United States. We have open lines 1-866-889-8894 outside the United States, 503-248-0620, toll-free 1-866-889-8894. Rick in Grand Rapids on the line. Rick, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Yes, happy Independence Day to both of you.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
And Bernie, I read the story on you in the Times magazine.
Yep.
Very good article, but I guess it was just too little of it. I'd like to read about you and your points of view. But real quick question here about the Sandra Day O'Connor retirement. I guess I'll just throw this out for everyone, the listeners and you too. What are the chances that Bush would nominate, for instance, an amiable conservative, and I'm not saying these two gentlemen personally, but people like John Danforth or Jack Kemp?
It's impossible to answer that question because we don't know it. But what has been really disappointing in terms of the appointments that the president has made is, in fact, there are a whole lot of moderate Republicans out there who are intelligent people who know the law. And why the president has gone to the extreme right wing is something that is extremely disappointing. I don't think he would appoint somebody like who has been critical of the right wing of the Republican Party. But let's hope that with enough pressure on that he might go to some responsible Republican.
Yeah, okay, good. Let us hope. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Bernie, Bush has tried to bury a report on CAFTA. I read about this in the Associated Press. The Labor Department worked for more than a year to hide this thing. Did you guys in Congress know about this?
No, well, we just learned about it recently. I'm in fact, I think, on the board of directors of the International Labor Rights Fund, which is the organization that won a contract from the Department of Labor to do research on labor rights in Central America in terms of understanding the impact that CAFTA would have. And, of course, what the conclusion that they came up with and what they wrote about was that workers do not have a lot of protection in Central America, that wages are extremely low. In Nicaragua, for example, I'm looking at a sheet, salaries are $2,300 a year, Honduras $2,600 a year, that when workers try to form unions, sometimes it's very difficult, it's discrimination against women. You're talking about very small economies that really have no way to stand up to large American corporations. I remember, Tom, a couple of years ago, workers from Honduras visited the state of Vermont, and we talked to them, and just the terrible abuse that these women went through in their plants, and they were fired when they stood up for their rights. So that's what the report was about, and the Bush administration's response to that report was to say, oh, well, you gave us conclusions that we don't like. Thank you. We're not publishing it. We're keeping it secret. And one of the members of Congress, through the Freedom of Information process, forced that out to the public, and the Bush administration is not happy about that.
They're not at all happy about it. One of the things that I've noticed also in the labor movement, it seems that there is an attempt to say, okay, trade deals are okay as long as the labor rights of people in other countries are respected. And I'm concerned that that may be, how do you say, I don't want to use really inflammatory language like saying it's a sellout of Americans, but you know, I'm not quite sure how else to characterize it. Why does somebody making $2 an hour in Nicaragua, that being actually a fairly decent minimum
wage? $2 an hour in Nicaragua would be a very good wage.
Right. Why does somebody making $2 an hour in Nicaragua, why should that give comfort to any American worker?
No, I think you're exactly right. I mean, and I was testified before the House Ways and Means Committee, Ways and Means Committee, not so long ago. And the simple point that I made is, you can talk about all the rights that you want and this, that, and the other thing. American workers should not be forced to compete against desperate people who make 20 or 30 cents an hour, even if they had rights. What does that right mean? I mean, even if they had rights, what kind of fair level playing field is that?
Yeah.
It's not.
It's not. It's absolutely not. Well, thank you for clarifying that. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. This is the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Our telephone number, toll-free, 1-866-889-8894. We'll be back with your calls and Congressman Sanders right after this.
For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, moving toward a bright and sparkling future by revitalizing democracy in the United States of America. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, click live chat. If you want to visit the blog and message board, you can click on that. If you want to read my articles on democracy, you can click on that. Lots of stuff there. But you know, drop into our live chat room during the program. Say hi. I read it during the breaks. And hang out with some of the finest minds on the whole entire Internet. Also, our telephone number, 866-889-8894. Michelle in Long Beach, California on the line. Hey, Michelle, what's up?
Oh, you know, I wanted to ask Bernie something, but I can still talk with you because, gosh, I enjoy that, too.
Well, thank you.
Listen, I'm a pretty active activist, if that isn't too redundant. And, you know, Tom, what keeps coming to mind every morning, I wake up and I get online and I sign petitions and I call my representatives. And what keeps coming to my mind, and to many of the people in the group that I'm with, it's a grassroots group, is, are we affecting them? Do they notice, you know, with the CAFTA, with the with Sandra Day O'Connor. I mean, we've got so many issues just hitting us left and right. Needless to say, the issues that hit us in the state that we have to, you know, stand up and try to be heard. Do you kind of see where I'm going with this? It's just, is there, do you hear, does Bernie tell you that he hears an effect in Washington by this, you know, the activists and their petitions?
Well, yeah, he makes that point, and it's very clear to me. The tide is turning. The tide is absolutely turning, Michelle. Things are changing. The people in this country are waking up. Look at the Zogby poll. The last Zogby poll just came out. 42% of Americans think that George W. Bush should be impeached if it can be demonstrated that he lied us into the Iraq War. 25% of Republicans think George W. Bush should be impeached. And impeachment is a pretty radical thing. I mean, this isn't just, hey, you know, maybe we should vote this guy down next time, although he can't run again. But, you know, impeachment? And this is a Zogby poll. This isn't something that the Democratic Party, I mean, this is an international polling company. No, they're absolutely right across the board. Yes, we're seeing defeats in some areas. The bankruptcy bill was a terrible thing. The CAFTA was just passed through the Senate. It's a terrible thing. There's a number of things that are destructive to the American way of life, in my opinion. But the point that Bernie made about CAFTA, for example, is that the margin of defeat was much smaller than it would have been 3 or 4 years ago. Politics in the United States tends to go back and forth. You know, the cycles, they swing back and forth. And we're swinging back toward the middle ground here in the United States, back toward rationality in politics. And you know, you look at the polls, and the majority of Americans, I mean, well over 80% of Americans, want there to be a national health care program in the United States like there is in every other country, in every other industrialized country in the world. And none of them are getting rid of theirs in a hurry. I mean, there's a reason why. It works. And more than 80% of Americans want that. The majority of Americans would prefer that George W. Bush did not reduce the standards and allow more mercury to be in our air, as he's trying to do with this so-called clear skies initiative. The majority of Americans really don't want the federal government in our local schools telling them how they should be tested and telling them exactly how they have to spend their money and then putting the squeeze on them. The majority of Americans are just, you know, broadly not in favor of the policies of this administration. And it's showing. And as Bernie said, a lot of his Republican colleagues are getting very nervous. So, Michelle, I think this is a good time for us. I think it's a good time for the United States. And you know, the right-wing cranks have had their chance. They came along with their ideology. It sounded good. It was, you know, this utopian ideology of, you know, if you just get government out of the way and let corporations run everything will be fine. And so we've got corporations, by and large, running the Iraqi war. And what? It's costing us billions of dollars more than it needs to. And, you know, the second largest army in Iraq is a corporate army. It's over 20,000 people. Some say as many as 100,000 when you include all the support personnel involved, that we're paying as much as $100,000 a day to these people for. It's costing us a fortune. We're being ripped off. And that's just, you know, one of many examples that we deregulated the energy industry. And so what happens? Enron goes into, you know, collusion with Arnold Schwarzenegger. They have a secret meeting in Los Angeles. And
right.
Boom, the energy crisis hits California. Gray Davis has made the villain. Schwarzenegger's now the governor. The people of California are waking up to this. So I don't want to say I'm not worried. Certainly there are things to be concerned about. My biggest concern, frankly, is the old thing about, you know, if you get a rat in a corner and that rat really knows he's cornered, that rat can become very dangerous, even though you're a 150-pound human being and that's a little, you know, 1.5-pound rat. I'm very concerned that if these folks see power slipping through their fingers, particularly with the possibility of the Democrats taking the House or the Senate in 2006, where they might then be able to actually begin investigations of the crimes of the Bush administration, that there may be something that will be politically exploitable, like another attack on the United States, a terrorist attack, or that suddenly we'll discover that we really have to go to war with Syria or Iran or something like that. That concerns me, frankly. But the trend, the direction in the United States, I'm very optimistic.
And I was going to say, you know, I push it all the time, but people really, really need to look at the voting rights and making sure that each state is working towards a fair voting system and get a hold of their representatives in their state and their governor and force that.
Because absolutely, absolutely.
That's fundamental to what you're talking about and what we're all worried about. Well,
thank you,
Tom.
Right.
I appreciate you gave me a better hope for Friday, and I will be thinking of our soldiers this weekend, as Bernie said, and our veterans. It's sad. It's just really sad, the cuts that they make, and if Everybody looks at the cuts that they're making. It's hitting all these programs. That
yeah, it is truly a disaster what the Republicans are doing to this country. Michelle, thank you so much for the call. Sandra Day O'Connor has just resigned. Sandra Day O'Connor was this is a much more important resignation, a much, much more important issue for America and Americans than it would be if Justice Rehnquist were to have resigned. Rehnquist was a conservative, a hardcore conservative, a hardcore conservative ideologue. And, of course, you know, Bush is going to put up a hardcore conservative ideologue to replace him. So, you know, if you replace Rehnquist, you're replacing one with another. Sandra Day O'Connor is a lifelong Republican, still is a registered Republican. She is a conservative Republican by her own description. She was nominated by Ronald Reagan and confirmed by the House and the Senate. She was, you know, largely well thought of by Republicans. And in many ways, her moderate position, number one, has earned her the hatred and attacks of the right wing. I mean, it's just been absolutely startling, the vitriol that has been charged against her. And on the other hand, she also was really the decisive vote in a number of cases. And it's important to look at these, because these are the cases that will change if Sandra Day O'Connor is replaced by somebody who is going to go in the Clarence Thomas, Scalia direction, Antonin Scalia direction of absolutely ideological, you know, forget about pragmatism, forget about what works and doesn't work, forget even about the historic ideals of democracy in the United States. You know, Justice Scalia saying, for example, you want rights. This is before a law school in Vermont. I was living there when he came and gave this speech. He said, he was talking about gay rights. He says, you want rights? Pass a law. He said, I don't see any right to homosexuality in the Constitution. And I'm like, what? The Constitution doesn't give us rights. The Constitution says right up front, our founders were very clear about it, we have all the rights. You know, God gave us the rights. Nature's God, to quote Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence. You know, the rights are ours, or, you know, if you're an atheist, you know, nature gave us the rights. Well, whatever, we have the rights. We the people, the first three words of the preamble to the Constitution, we the people of the United States, we hold the rights. In the Federalist Papers, as I recall, it was Federalist 54, Federalist 70, I don't know, it was Hamilton, one of Hamilton's. Hamilton was arguing against there being a Bill of Rights attached to the Constitution. And he said, in a very real sense, the entire Constitution is a Bill of Rights. Adding a Bill of Rights to it would make it redundant. His point was, he was very concerned that if they added a Bill of Rights to it, that people would think that with the Constitution we were giving people rights, when in fact all the Constitution does is say there are some areas of all the rights of we the people that we the people collectively, by ratifying this Constitution, are saying we're going to give up to government for the greater good. That is to say, for example, here's an example. This is not a constitutional example, but, you know, the right to run through a red light. I mean, you don't have that because we have collectively decided we're going to eliminate that right because we don't want to see dead bodies all over the place. I mean, we collectively get together and say, you know, there are times when we have to surrender a certain number of our rights, a certain small portion of our rights in order to have a functioning government, you know, to protect ourselves. But that it should be very, very small, a very, very, very small number. And so many of our rights have been wiped out over the last 50 years, the last 100 years. I'm very concerned about this. And the Bush administration seems, you know, absolutely bent to, you know, totally committed to removing even more of our rights. So let's look at some of the cases where Sandra Day O'Connor's vote was the decisive vote. This is really important stuff. Grutter versus Bollinger in 2003. This was a case that affirmed the rights of state colleges and universities to use affirmative action in their admissions policies to increase educational opportunities for minorities. Now, on the one hand, I agree with conservatives who say at some point, with regard to affirmative action, at some point you have to say, okay, the playing field is now level. We're going to stop these programs because they are reverse discrimination. You have to acknowledge that. I mean, liberals have to acknowledge that. On the other hand, however, we have to also look at what's actually happening. Are African Americans at parity with whites? Are women at parity with men? No. We still have in this country the echo of 200 years, 300 years, 400, really 400 years, arguably, of institutionalized racism and slavery and segregation and the oppression of women by men. We still have that echo. It's still very much with us. It's still part of our society. And so it's still appropriate, in my opinion, that we have affirmative action. Over time, obviously, we would like to diminish that. And I think that people of all races, you know, agree with that. But she was the one. She was the one who said, you know, we're not there yet. We haven't achieved racial equality yet. So it is appropriate that universities and colleges still continue to consider race as in their admissions policies. That case. The second one, Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation versus the EPA. This was a 2004 case that said the EPA could step in and take action to reduce air pollution under the Clean Air Act if a state conservation agency fails to act. In other words, if there are federal standards, and this, you know, and this, of course, is one of the things a lot of conservatives are very concerned about. Prior to the Civil War, we had strong states and a weak federal government. The major change of the Civil War was that we now have a strong federal government and relatively weak states. That's simply the reality. That's what the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments brought us in some part, along with freeing the slaves after the Civil War. And so we have agreed, you know, that we're going to have national standards for clean air. And in this case, the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation versus the EPA, the Supreme Court ruled in a 5-4 decision, Sandra Day O'Connor being the vote that decided it, that if a state won't enforce their clean air laws, the federal government can require them to. The cons would like to roll that back. If Sandra Day O'Connor gets replaced, it will be 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, I've heard that other countries are down on the U.S., a land of mass consumption, our lives filled with excess. But my daddy wasn't fighting on Normandy that day for the right to drive a Hyundai. I refuse to live that way.
Uh-oh. Where's this going?
I'm proud to be an American who gets just 5 mpg. Though I live alone, the car I own can seat 103. And I'll gladly park so close to you, when you pull out, you can't see. No, I'll never trade my Escalade. God bless my SUV.
Oh, isn't it? It's humorous, tragic. Yeah. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number 1-866-889-8894. The place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I think not. I think the Supreme Court got it right in 1886 in the Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad case, and the court reporter, John Chandler Bancroft Davis, got it wrong when he wrote in the headnote that corporations are persons, because it ain't what the court ruled, but it stood for 150 years, and it hasn't stood us well. Brian in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line, listening on WPTT. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. Always a fine line between comedy and tragedy. Great bumper song there.
Yeah, I agree.
I've been in the car all day, so I haven't listened. So if I'm bringing up a point that someone might have mentioned before, CAFTA.
Yeah.
I remember it must have been about 10 years ago. You'd probably know the exact year. Clinton was president. When they passed GATT, driving down the road and just the sickening feeling I had. Now, we can see the results of NAFTA and GATT. How can these people look us in the eye and tell us that CAFTA would be wonderful? Just wonderful.
The only answer that I can come up with, Brian, on that, the only conclusion I can come to, is that they are getting so much money and so much pressure, or they are so afraid of losing their seats, their political power, that they're willing to lie to us in order to keep it.
Always boils down to that, the almighty dollar, and
well,
who's going to get them reelected.
See, no, yes and no. I mean, I'm not suggesting that our politicians are inherently corrupt. What we have is a corrupt political system. And I think that there are a lot of people who went into politics for the very best reasons, and they're stuck making these horrible decisions like CAFTA for the very worst reasons. But if they don't make that decision, then they're going to get steamrollered I mean, you know, if, for example, here in Oregon, where I am, both of our senators, a Democrat and a Republican, voted in favor of CAFTA. Well, who are the most powerful corporations in the state? Nike, right? Nike makes their living, I mean, makes their money by international, you know, by cheap labor, cheap overseas labor. And as the price of oil goes up, And up and up. It's going to be more and more expensive to import things from China. Plus, our trade tensions, you know, our military tensions with China are cranking up. So trade is, may become more difficult. So I have to think that Phil Knight is looking at Central America going, you know, here's a new labor force. They make, you know, half of those 44 million people make less than $2 a day. We can make shoes down there just as easily as in China. Let's do that. And so, you know, what politician wants to go up against some guy who's worth $15 billion?
True. And don't you think Nike probably made enough money on NAFTA already?
But yeah, I don't disagree. But the reality is that, you know, in a small state with a huge corporation, they can squash a politician like a bug. That needs to be fixed. It's the system, in my opinion, that's broken. We need to go to a system. Ideally, at the very least, we need to do what the British have done. What the British have done is they have said, if I understand this correctly, if you're going to run for Parliament, if you're going to stand for Parliament, you cannot spend in any way, in total aggregate, you or anybody advocating for you cannot spend more than £100,000, the equivalent of maybe $170,000 U.S. That's it, period. You can spend it over a week, you can spend it over 6 months, but that's it. That's all that can be spent. And anybody who runs an ad for you is counted as one of your ads. Anybody who runs an ad that even implies something good about you is counted as one of your ads. And you can't spend more than that £100,000. If we did that here in the United States, I think we'd clean up politics like that overnight. Problem is, it violates the First Amendment. You know, we say, well, then our First Amendment free speech rights are being violated. So how do you do it? Well, perhaps with clean election laws like they have in Maine and Arizona, where you have public financing. The public will put in the money. I think that may help. It's 29 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. You're in the real free speech zone. The pill that will help you escape the matrix. You want the red pill or the green pill or the blue pill? Well, let's see. Red states, blue pill. The other day I said, it's the blue pill. And somebody sent me an email going, no, Tom, it's the red pill. No. It's like the states, not like the movie. Well, you can take it either way. Anyhow, welcome back to our program. Thank you so much for being with us. David K. Johnson wrote this piece recently. The non-tax-paying affluent grew by 15% in 1 year. This is the result of Bush's changes in tax laws. The chances of having a large income but not paying any taxes on it whatsoever are growing. The number of affluent individuals and married couples who paid no federal income taxes jumped by more than 15% in 2002. About one out of every 436 high-income Americans paid no taxes whatsoever in 2002, up from one in 531 in 2001, and one in 1,010 in the year 2000 itself. It's rather startling, eh? Well, maybe not. I don't know. It's one of the biggest changes that George Bush Jr. put into place with his most recent tax cut, as it were. One of the biggest changes was that he said, if you earn your living sitting on your butt waiting for the dividend check to arrive, that's how you earn your living, then you only have to pay a maximum of 15% income. Whereas if you make your living by working, then, you know, you have to pay up into the 30s. But maximum 15% if you earn your living sitting around waiting for the dividend check to arrive as you're sitting by the pool. Those who earn their living by investing, 15%, maximum 15% income tax rate. And this is the law now. I mean, this took effect last year. So it shouldn't surprise us, you know, the well-off are doing well-off. I mean, remember when Bush first started selling this thing? It's just continues to boggle my mind. He suggested that if we gave tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires, that somehow they would want to, because they had more money in their pocket, they would want to run right out and build a factory. Now, speaking as somebody who has actually built a factory, yeah, I really did. We had an herbal tea company back in the early 70s called the Woodley Herber Company, and we had 18 employees, and we actually built a factory. I mean, we made a factory. We took a building and turned it into a factory. Okay, and I'll tell you, I didn't do it because I had money in my pocket. In fact, I started that company with the income from nothing. I mean, basically from a job that I had. I mean, I started it with nothing, which is how most small businesses start. I was still 23 years old, something like that, and we built this company up until it was doing fairly well. And I didn't do it because somebody gave me the money. I did it because I knew that there were people who wanted to buy the product that I was making. That's the only reason that people go into business. They don't build a factory because the government gives them a tax break. They build a factory because they perceive a need for their product. If there's a need for the product, then they can sell the product. If you sell the product, you can make money. It's very simple. How is it the conservatives don't get this? I'm just completely baffled by this. I've heard so many talk show hosts, you know, when the big tax thing was going on, I heard so many talk show hosts say, well, I never heard of a poor man giving anybody a job. I'll tell you, I was a poor man, and I gave 18 people jobs. I think the year that we started that company, my total taxable income was probably $5,000. I mean, first couple of years, every business that I started, the first couple of years of the business, you take no money out of it. That's what entrepreneurs do. You build up the business, and then if it does well, you make it on the backside. But it's so Bush comes out and he says,
with a robust package of at least $550 billion and across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
Now, just do this math for a minute, okay? $550 billion in tax cuts. $550 billion will create 1 million jobs. That's the same thing as saying $550 billion to 1 million is the same as 550,000 to 1. In other words, if you divide both by a million, you end up with 550,000 to 1, because a billion is 1,000 million. So 550,000 million is 550 billion, right? So 550,000 will create... So he was saying, and I'm still just mystified by this, because he went around the country and said this over and over and over again, and I never in a newspaper saw anybody say George Bush proposes to spend $550,000 per job for the jobs that he says he's going to create. Now, keep in mind, of course, it didn't work. Bush has been in power 5 years now, and he's still 90,000 jobs, more or less. Some say 80,000 jobs. Some say his administration says there's only 27,000 jobs. He's still in the net negative territory. He's still below zero. He is the first president since Herbert Hoover to have not created one single job on his watch. And how could he get away? Just listen to this one more time. $550 billion. A billion is 1,000 million. So it's $550,000 million. To create 1 million new jobs, $550,000 per job. Why didn't he just give each one of us find 1 million unemployed people and give each one of them $550,000? They will go out and spend it, and that spending will cause entrepreneurs like me all across America to say, "Hey, these people want to buy something. I'm going to start a business and sell it to them." Listen to this.
With a robust package of at least $550 billion and across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
And it didn't. Of course it didn't. Well, actually, I should be a little more accurate. George Bush, with his $550 billion tax cut, and which has now become, by the way, about a $3.5 trillion tax cut, because that was just the first one. George Bush's tax cuts have created millions of jobs in China and in India, but not here in the United States. But he never said he was creating jobs here in the United States. You notice that? He doesn't say it in the United States.
With a robust package of at least $550 billion and across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
But not here in the United States. I mean, it's just... How do they get away? By the way, I know this is a radical change of topic, but I just have to deal with this for 1 minute because I'm getting so many emails from people about this and so much discussion about this. Apparently, somebody is out there stirring the pot, doing the circuit. Maybe somebody's got a new book out, whatever, saying that we all know on 9/11, on the day of 9/11, there was no video footage of the plane, of the first plane hitting the tower. There was none. It wasn't until the day after, 9/12, that some amateur photographer figured out how to sell their videotape to one of the networks, and we saw the first plane. We saw a video of the first plane hitting the tower. We saw a video of the second plane hitting the tower on 9/11, because after the first plane hit the tower, every news camera in New York was pointing up at the World Trade Center. But there was no video of the first plane hitting the tower. And so George Bush told a slightly different story. And there are folks who are running around saying the reason he told this story is because the Bush administration somehow was involved in setting up 9/11, and they had cameras monitoring the towers to make sure that the planes actually hit them, and this is proof of a conspiracy. I don't buy it. Okay, my take on it is that George W. Bush Jr. is a pathological liar, and he just routinely lies, and that this is just an example of him doing it. And so, but I'll let you decide. Here he is.
Well, Jordan, you're not going to believe what state I was in when I heard about the terrorist attack. I was in Florida, and my chief of staff, Andy Card. Well, actually, I was in a classroom talking about a reading program that works. And I was sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower the TV was obviously on, and I used to fly myself, and I said, well, there's one terrible pilot, and I said it must have been a horrible accident, but I was whisked off there. I didn't have much time to think about it. I was sitting in the classroom, and Andy Card, my chief of staff, was sitting over here, walked in and said, a second plane has hit the tower. America's under attack.
So, you know, there he is, George Bush, saying that he watched the first tower being hit when nobody in America saw the first tower being hit until 24 hours later on videotape. And as I said, I don't think that this is proof. And I just want to be on the record as saying it because I'm getting so many emails from people about this. I know somebody's out there running around talking about this. I'm not sure who or where. I don't think that this is proof that George was involved in some sort of conspiracy to make 9/11 happen. I do believe that 9/11 happened because of the incompetence of the Bush administration, and it wouldn't surprise me if there was some truth to the suggestion being put forth that they intentionally looked the other way. And frankly, I think that probably the reason for that is because they didn't want to embarrass the Saudis, because Osama bin Laden was a Saudi, and Osama bin Laden was a patron to the Bush family, or not Osama, but the bin Laden families were patrons to the Bush family, and they didn't want to embarrass them, and they didn't, you know, they were just kind of hoping it would blow over and go away, or whatever, or that it wouldn't come out that it was Osama or something. I don't pretend to know all the answers, But I think that 9/11 happened because of these guys' incompetence, not because they made it happen. So I just be on the record for that, because people are like, you know, come on, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? Isn't this the proof? Here's the smoking gun. Why don't we impeach him right now? Blah, 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 blah. And no, it's just you look back. There's just so many dozens of examples where George W. Bush will just say things off the top of his head, without any, you know, just make things up on the fly, because that's just his nature. That's, you know, how he's always gotten by in life. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. John in Crescent City, California, on the line. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Welcome to the left coast.
Thank you.
I just wanted to let you know I was driving back from fishing, and I had to send an email to Diane Feinstein letting her know she lost my vote on CAFTA because of her vote on CAFTA. I don't know how many, or so few Democrats, so I don't know how many they are, but how many of them can play with the Republicans while Rome burns? It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, do you know how Kerry voted on it?
I don't, but I'll find out. I think I can find out fairly quickly here.
Okay, because the whole election with Kerry, I want to make a point about Kerry versus Bush and your comments on Bush.
Sure.
It's if you vote, you vote for somebody's character. You can't escape that fact. Their policies are important, but you look at the individual. And with John Kerry, you had an individual, for all his flaws, who participated in the two major events of his lifetime, the Vietnam War and the anti-war movement.
Yeah, like
he was there.
John,
he was dodging it.
Yeah, I agree. John Kerry voted no on CAFTA. Here's the list of the Democrats who voted yes. Binghamton of New Mexico, Cantwell of Washington State, Carper of Delaware, Feinstein of California, Lincoln of Arkansas, Murray of Washington State, Nelson of Florida, Nelson of Nebraska, Pryor of Arkansas, and Wyden of Oregon. That's it. Those are the Democrats who voted yes.
Well, I'm glad to note that Barbara Boxer isn't there.
Yeah. No, yeah. She's not. And I just, you know, I'm baffled by any of these Democrats who voted yes. There was a whole bunch of Republicans who voted no. Burns of Montana, Collins of Maine, Craig of Idaho, Crapo of Idaho, Enzi of Wyoming, Graham of South Carolina, Shelby Graham, interesting. Shelby of Alabama, Olympia Snow in Maine, Arlen Specter voted no, Republican from Pennsylvania. Thomas of Wyoming, John Thune in South Dakota voted no, Vitter in Louisiana, Jim Jeffords voted no. So, and in fact, I had said earlier that he had said yes. It says here, independent yes, Jeffords, Vermont. I'm not sure. Oh, that's apparently Jeffords voted yes. I'm sorry, I'm misreading it.
Yeah. Well, and at least those Republicans are sensible enough to look at their constituents and the oxes that are being gored in their home states.
Yeah, and the one guy who didn't vote, by the way, was Joe Lieberman. Joe Lieberman did not vote.
There was another Dodger.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
So
anyway, I just, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you rock.
Well, thank you.
You got the intellect and the horsepower to carry a good message, and I'm glad to welcome you to the Left Coast.
Well, thanks, John. It's great. It's great living out here. I appreciate it, and I appreciate your call. It's very kind of you. And I tell you, Portland, Oregon, is one of the finest cities in America. Although I still love Vermont, and I miss it a lot, but it sure is nice being out here in the West as well. So I, you know, they're both my homes, and Michigan as well. I mean, where I grew up. So I guess I'm and Georgia, where I spent a decade, and I lived for a year in Germany. I'm not sure I consider myself a German, so I'll go there. But anyhow, yeah, that's the situation with who voted how on NAFTA and on CAFTA rather, and it is now going to the House of Representatives. And Debbie Stabenow, by the way, voted against it. Barack Obama voted against it. Joe Biden voted against it. I mean, a lot of Democrats who voted in favor of the bankruptcy bill, for example. Obama, it turns out, did not vote in favor of the bankruptcy bill. But a lot of them who did not vote for CAFTA. So I think that they're starting to see the light. What we need to do is hold their feet to the fire. We need to be saying, you know, how can you call yourself a Democrat and still stand up and say that you're in favor of, for example, that insane bankruptcy bill that got passed. That's the you know, it's like, okay, we all see that a train wreck is coming as a result of the economic policies of both Democratic and Republican administrations over the last 25 years. We all see there's a train wreck coming. And so let's get the banks and corporations out of the way so that 100% of the burden when that train wreck happens, that economic train wreck happens, will fall on the average middle-class person. And at the same time that they're hyping this, you know, get in debt, get in debt, get in debt. What are the most of the advertising you see on TV these days? You know, you can refinance your home. You refinance your home with us. Refinance your home here. Get in debt. Get more in debt. Get deeper in debt. You can buy a car, no interest. It's all about debt. Debt is slavery, my friends. Debt is slavery. And the slaveholders, they want to make sure that if you're in debt, you're going to have to pay it off every last little penny forever. World without end. Amen. 10 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on RadioPower.org, Live 365's American FM, and RadioPower.org, which is also podcasting our program now. So welcome back to our program. Just as Sandra Day O'Connor has just announced her retirement, it's the last day of the week. It's the day that traditionally we spend the first hour of our program. The only, really, this is not so much a guest-driven program. This is the only hour that I think I've ever given an entire hour to a guest. And the reason why is because Bernie is this hour. Bernie Sanders, I believe, is America's congressman. He's the only independent member of the United States House of Representatives, the only member who's not a Democrat or a Republican. And just, in my opinion, just stands up and tells the truth. His website, Bernie.org, Bernie.org, and Congressman Bernie Sanders. Bernie, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. And Bernie, Sandra Day O'Connor just announced her resignation.
Yep.
Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's going to open up now an enormous struggle in terms of who is going to be replacing her, what that process will be, and also Rehnquist is sitting there not in good health, and we don't know what his future plans are, but it's not impossible that he'll retire as well. So I think right now it is a time for the American people to demand that the president, in fact, consult with the United States Senate, not try to ram through some right-wing extremist. And that is going to be a very interesting process.
Yeah, in some ways, Sandra Day O'Connor's resignation, or replacement, let's say, is even more important than Rehnquist, because with Rehnquist, you're replacing a conservative with a conservative. Sandra Day O'Connor, although she is a Republican, she was nominated by Ronald Reagan, a Republican, she describes herself as a conservative, and she is conservative in the traditional way in most of her perspectives. She was the swing vote on abortion, the swing vote on affirmative action, the swing vote on the death penalty. Whoever replaces her is going to change the complexion of this court.
Absolutely. I mean, in one instance, if we lose this, we're looking at the loss of a woman's right to choose and other very, very important issues. So you're right. More than Rehnquist, this is an enormous struggle, and I hope the Democrats in the Senate are prepared to make that fight for the American people, and I hope the American people are engaged in it. We have a constitution. We have a process. The president has a right to make an appointment, but it has to go through the Senate, and it must go through in a fair process, not rammed through. So this is an issue that the American people should pay very rapt attention to.
Now, the Democrats in the Senate just rolled over yesterday on CAFTA. Do you think that?
Well, they didn't roll. I mean, the point is, from an historical perspective, as bad as that vote was on CAFTA, it is better than it has been in previous votes.
Okay.
The Senate has been a disaster in terms of unfettered free trade. The CAFTA fight now is going to come to the House. We think it may come as early as the week that we get back after the July 4th break. And right now it looks very, very close. If the vote were today, I think we would win it and we'd be able to stop CAFTA. But the White House and corporate America, of course, are doing everything they can to win votes over. So it's going to be a real tough struggle. And I think in terms of the sentiment of the American people, and you and I have discussed this quite often, there has been a huge transformation on the trade issue. And the American people now understand that unfettered free trade is a disaster for the middle class of this country. When you look at countries in Latin America, in Central America, that will be impacted by CAFTA, what you're looking at is a situation where you have 40% of workers in Central America making less than $2 a day. Friends, that is our competition.
And these people are a great market that's going to buy all kinds of American-made
stuff?
No
doubt. I mean,
somehow I don't think so.
Of course not. And we know that we have a $618 billion trade deficit. We know the trade deficit with China is a disaster, and it's growing. And the middle class is shrinking. And I believe that one of the key reasons why people are working longer hours for lower wages is because we are asking our people to compete against desperate people in countries like Nicaragua or in China, and that is wrong. So right now, in terms of the House, if the vote were today, I think we would be able to stop the agreement, but it is very close. The White House has the capability of making individual deals with members of Congress. Corporate America has, I think, made it very clear that those people who are prepared to vote against CAFTA may not get campaign contributions and so forth and so on. So I would urge the listeners, if they're concerned about the survival of the middle class, the preservation of decent-paying jobs, and the people of Central America who will be overwhelmed by corporate America, to get a hold of your member of Congress and say, vote no on CAFTA.
Yeah, because this is past the Senate. It's now in the House of Representatives.
Right.
So that's where the next battle will be.
But the vote, Tom, was not a surprise. In fact, some people who thought it could have even been worse.
Yeah, okay.
We had a number of Republicans who voted no, and that was a good sign.
Yeah, it was 13, wasn't it?
I think it was.
Yeah, something like that. It was. I saw the breakout this morning, and I thought, well, that's really interesting there. So, and in fact, this is an issue. I mean, you often talk on this program about your friend Ron Paul, who's one of the most conservative members of the House of Representatives, and I think probably one of the last true conservatives in the House of Representatives who's really holding to his principles. There are. I just don't understand how these guys can say that they're Republicans and they're conservatives and they want to surrender the sovereignty of the United States to multinational corporations.
Well, the answer to that is that a lot of these so-called conservatives, under no sense of that word, no definition of that word, are in fact conservatives. And that starts with the president. You remember, it's interesting, the president doesn't even bother to use the word compassion and conservative anymore, does he?
No.
You hear that very rarely.
No.
He is a right-wing extremist who will use the power of government in any way that he sees fit. One of the things that we have seen, doesn't get a whole lot of publicity, is time after time, the federal government under the Republicans are preempting states' rights. Where states have consumer protection, for example, the federal government has said, not respecting the states, they said, hey, we're going to override what you do. We're going to make your work irrelevant, and we will impose federal standards to do away with the strongest standards that states have imposed. So these guys are not conservative. It is not conservative to have a USA Patriot Act, which gives the federal government and the FBI all kinds of power to be spying on the American people. That is not conservative. It is not conservative to be engaging in preemptive warfare. Whatever you may think of the war in Iraq, that certainly is not part of a conservative philosophy. So these guys are anything but conservative.
In fact, oddly, the Republicans were the ones who led the charge against World War I, World War II, the Korean War.
They were isolationists, and I'm not an isolationist, but at least their view was everything being equal, you don't go into war unless you absolutely positively have to.
Right, and that's a view that really goes back to, frankly, George Washington.
That's right. That's right.
Now, two quick things that I wanted to ask you about, and then we'll take a break and we can get to our callers' questions. But first, I understand you've had some legislative victories recently.
We had a really good victory earlier in the week. If you can believe this, as part of the Export-Import Bank process, a $5 billion loan went to Westinghouse Electric, which is owned, in fact, by the British government. To do what? What was this $5 billion loan going to do? You know what it was going to do? It was going to build nuclear power plants in China for a Chinese company, which is owned by the Chinese government, which has been implicated in giving nuclear secrets to Pakistan and Iran.
So the taxpayers of the United States are going to loan money to a company based in England to build...
Owned by the British government. Oh. Nationalized company.
Okay. And to build nuclear power plants in China. What possible rationale?
You got me.
It was just the company was walking around Congress passing out money?
Westinghouse is not an insignificant company. And once we were able to bring it to the floor, we won by a quite large vote. Now the struggle will be to make sure that we win it in the Senate and that we keep it in the conference committee. But I think once you brought it out in the open, people had a very hard time not laughing at this absurd
proposal. Where was the House leadership and where was the president on this topic, on this issue?
Oh, the president, of course, is strongly supportive, and the House leadership is supportive, although we got a number of Republicans who said, hey, give me a break, this is absurd. But so it was a question of bringing it onto the floor, and when we did, we won by a good vote.
So how could the president justify that?
Oh, God. You could justify anything. It's part of, it's too absurd for me to even think about how you justify it. It's part of our ongoing good relationship with China. Oh, it's going to create jobs in the United States in the nuclear technology area. Although, by the way, the Chinese have been absolutely insistent that the technology within these plants will be theirs. It's not like somebody's building it for them. They will adopt that technology.
Yeah. So you shot that one down. That was a good one. Good on you. Okay. And now George Bush has set up a domestic spy service. This headline, U.S. President George W. Bush has ordered the creation of a domestic intelligence service within the FBI as a part of a package of 70 new security measures. I thought after the abuses of the Nixon era that you guys passed a law that made it illegal for the FBI or for any domestic police agency to spy on American citizens unless there was evidence of a crime.
Well, this is the whole direction that the Bush administration is moving in. There are terrific and terrible attacks on civil liberties, basic freedoms, the USA Patriot Act. And these guys are moving aggressively in many ways to make us a less free country. So this is part of a long list of things that they have done.
This is just your basic assault on liberty.
Right. I mean, and again, if this is conservative, then we don't know what the word conservative is. Spying on the American people is not conservative. I mean, the bottom line here, once again, in my view, as I've said many times, terrorism is, in fact, serious business. The function of the government is to protect the American people from terrorism. But we can do that in a way that does not undermine basic constitutional rights, that does not have the FBI spying on innocent Americans. But this is, again, not unrelated to their whole attack on the federal judiciary and doing away with the separation of powers, which means that you have an independent judiciary whose function is to protect constitutional rights and be prepared to take on an administration. They're attacking that as well.
Yeah. Now, just before the Patriot Act was passed, we had a terrorist attack in the United States, anthrax attack. It only attacked the two people in the United States Senate who could have stopped the Patriot Act, Tom Daschle, who was the head of the Senate Democrats. The Senate had been taken back by the Democrats when Jim Jeffords left the Republican Party, and Patrick Leahy of Vermont, who was the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Those were the two guys who could have stopped the Patriot Act. They got anthrax. All of a sudden, they got religion, apparently, about the Patriot Act.
No, I wouldn't go there.
You think I mischaracterized it? Okay. But I'm curious if you know if there's been any progress on finding out who attacked us with those anthrax.
The answer is I don't think there is any more information on that than you have read in the newspaper, and you haven't read anything in the newspaper.
Yeah.
It does remain unresolved.
Is this administration just given up on this?
No, I suspect that the FBI and the folks are investigating it, but they have not come up with the culprits yet.
Yeah, let us hope so. Okay, we just have a few seconds left. I just wanted to repeat, Sandra Day O'Connor, for our people who are just tuning in, Sandra Day O'Connor has resigned. She, the swing vote for abortion rights, a number of issues, affirmative action, death penalty, things like this. And this is going to be a really significant issue, time for people to start really paying attention to what's going on in Washington, D.C.
Absolutely.
We are talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's our regular Brunch with Bernie segment. If you'd like to talk with Bernie, call 1-866, toll-free, 1-866-889-8894. 866-889-8894. We'll be right back.
Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, the third hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. Truth in Broadcasting. You're in the middle of the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Truth and common sense in broadcasting. Should we be subsidizing Walmart with our tax dollars? Should we be subsidizing, for that matter, should we be subsidizing any large employer with our tax dollars? This article, I believe this was in the New York Times, starts out, Susan Medinger-Paul went into labor in 1995 and gave birth prematurely to her third child. She knew the health insurance provided by her employer would not cover the cost, nor would it pay for the birth of her fourth and fifth child later on in 98-99. She said she relied on Minnesota Care, the state's public assistance health care, to pay for multiple hospitalizations of her children, two of whom suffered from asthma. She has a good-paying job as an accountant at Walmart. So why is she on the dole? Well, she says, because Walmart's health insurance is awful. She said, I had two preemies, and they both had asthma. So now states are starting to say, enough already. John Corzine and Ted Kennedy have sponsored legislation called the Health Care Accountability Act that would require states to publicly report the number of their employees who are employed and getting public assistance. You know, back to the idea of what is a living wage, employed and getting public assistance. And it's an issue. I want to share a little more with you about this in just a moment. First, our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, if you'd like to call in. Eric in Cleveland on the line. Hey, Eric, what's up?
It is a pleasure to be speaking with you. How are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better. And yeah. And I hope you have a wonderful weekend, Eric, by the way.
I appreciate that. Not as exotic as Iceland over here in Cleveland, but I can imagine the winters are pretty similar.
Yeah.
In any case, Cleveland's got your back, too. Just want to let you know that. Mad respect for you.
Thank you.
There's so many concerns that I have, but one of the main concerns, I'd like to hear you speak about it because you can articulate so well, is regarding the fairness doctrine, which was repealed under the Reagan administration. After that was repealed...
It wasn't actually repealed. They just stopped enforcing it. It's still there.
It's still there. So what can we do to get them to enforce it? Because I think that is the main problem. I think all people, all Americans are good people, essentially. It's just that when you have propaganda and you become brainwashed, it's very difficult if everybody's listening to Fox and Limbaugh to tell them the truth.
Yeah.
So what can we do
to enforce it? There's a couple of different aspects of the Fairness Doctrine. First of all, the what determines whether or not the Fairness Doctrine and the provisions that are associated with it get enforced or not is the Federal Communications Commission. It's an FCC regulation. And and that's how Reagan was able to say, just, you know, stop enforcing it, you know, because he appointed, the FCC has five commissioners. And typically... It's two and two, you know, two Democrats, two Republicans, and then the swing commissioner is typically, whichever party happens to be in power at the time. And so they just stopped enforcing that, and it really never came back. I have to say, you know, I worked in radio back when the Fairness Doctrine was in effect. I started in radio in the late 1960s and worked in radio right up through 1978 and, you know, then got out of the business for a while and then came back in 3 years ago to start doing progressive talk radio. And back then, and I worked in news for 7 years in Lansing, Michigan, WITL in Lansing, Michigan, and we had a daily talk show. And we could not touch politics because with the Fairness Doctrine, you had to be very, very careful that anything you said, you had to give the opposite side. And it gets kind of absurd. In fact, it's brought about the mentality of the Fairness Doctrine has brought about this strange situation where you can have 2,600 of the world's top scientists say global warming is here and it's a disaster looming, and then you get five crackpot scientists who are in the employ of right-wing fringe groups who are getting their money from ExxonMobil, and they come out and they say, no, there's no such thing, don't worry. And people in the media think that they have to give them equal say, right? It's like, how do you know what is equal say? What is fair? And that's a problem, frankly, I think, left over from the mentality of the Fairness Doctrine. So I'm not, at that level, I'm not in favor of the Fairness Doctrine. On the other hand, there were provisions in the Fairness Doctrine, or the laws associated with it, that required radio stations and television stations, if they were going to use the public airwaves, to give back to the public, that is, to perform a public service in exchange for those public airwaves, and that was that they had to provide some sort of benefit to the community. And the way that was typically done was two things. Of course, there were the old public service announcements we all remember, you know, hey, there's going to be a meeting at the church on Thursday night, and you show up, it'll be a potluck, that kind of thing. And most people think that that was the main thing, but it wasn't. The main public service that radio and television provided back when these rules were being enforced was called news. And the news,
right.
and the radio and TV, the TV networks and radio networks, but in particular the TV networks, the big three, ABC, CBS, NBC, they all understood that their local affiliates had to provide good, solid news, news that was of community value, or they couldn't keep their licenses. And so the news divisions of the networks and the news divisions of the local radio stations, the radio station that I worked at in Michigan, we had like 7-8 people on our staff, you know, for a little tiny radio station. Well, not little tiny. Lansing's not an insignificant town, but it's not a huge town. And it was losing, in all probability, losing money, the news division. But we did that because that's what you had to do to keep your license. And
right.
And what happened was when they stopped enforcing that dimension of the Fairness Doctrine and that community service provision, as it were, and Reagan kind of privatized the airwaves, as it was.
Exactly.
Then what happened was everybody said, oh, we don't have to provide news as a community service anymore. Therefore, there's no standards for it anymore. Therefore, it doesn't have to be news anymore. It can be infotainment. It can be part of our entertainment division. It can be part of our making money project, our making money division. And therefore, even if Michael Jackson trial doesn't serve the public interest, we can go 24 hours wall to wall Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
And forget about the real things that are happening in the world, because those aren't going to get the ratings. things, and we don't have a public service obligation anymore. So I'm in favor of bringing back the public service requirements, but I think, frankly, that we've gone too far, with regard to the Fairness Doctrine. I think we've gone around the edge on that one. That's not going to come back. And I, frankly, personally, I'm not sure that it should come back. I don't think that it should. But I do think that the community service requirements, so that news becomes news again, should come back.
Right.
Makes sense?
That's the best option that we have. You definitely didn't disappoint me with your explanation, as usual. But
okay.
One last thing, and,
sure.
And then, I'll let you go. So what can be done, to separate, Fox News Channel from Fox Opinion Channel, that kind of thing? What is the best thing that we can do to restore the balance?
Well, with regard to cable, cable is a funny animal, because cable is running over, it's not running over the public airwaves. So
right.
On the one hand, you can't
say
it's, but it is running over public rights of way. We maintain the roads and things that cables are strung on, and in many cases communities maintain the telephone poles. And so the deal that they made with the cable industry is they said, you have to provide community service as well. And the way that you do that is you have to give local access to people. Local cable access. And so that's the cable industry's version of what used to be news for radio and TV. Radio and TV no longer have that obligation. Cable still does. But any kind of propaganda can be on cable or on radio and TV, for that matter, and there it is. I mean, it's
right. And, so the normal citizen doesn't have many options, is what you're saying.
The main option, frankly, I believe, I think that most Democrats get it, the kind of damage that's been done to our democracy, frankly, and to our public discourse broadly, but to our democracy as well, by the loss of that public service requirement with regard to public airwaves. And by the way, this is something that goes all the way back to the founding of the Republic. We subsidized newsprint and postage for newspapers starting in the 1780s. And this was something Ben Franklin fought for. And to this day, we subsidize the postage for newspapers. The post office loses money mailing newspapers, and yet they still do it. Because the idea is that democracy has to have an informed electorate. So anyhow, with regard to cable, that's their give back. But the solution, in my opinion, is that we need to elect a Democratic administration, frankly. Because I think that the Democrats get it, and they will, if you have a Democratic president, that Democratic president will appoint somebody to the FCC who will become the swing vote, who will have the power to start, reinforcing these laws and perhaps breaking up some of the really large, really grotesque monopolies, this AOL, Time Warner, CNN, blah, 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 everything. This is a clear violation, in my opinion, of the Sherman Antitrust Act. Not to mention the FCC rules. So that's where I'm at. So, Eric, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. And thanks for listening to us there on Radio Free Ohio. I do appreciate it. Beth in Florida on the line. Hey, Beth, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I am great. What's up?
Good. I had a comment about the living wage. I think that, the president should have to, endure 2 months of living off of minimum wage to, before he's elected president to have a feeling for what most of the country goes through their whole entire lives.
Yeah, I think, Richard Nixon understood what it meant to be in the middle class. Dwight Eisenhower understood what it meant to be in the middle class. Jack Kennedy didn't, but his brother sort of got it. I've told that story before on this program. They had a sense, at least, of noblesse oblige, of the obligation of nobility. Lyndon Johnson understood it. He cut poverty in half in the United States in 2 years with the Great Society program. It was actually a very successful program. So I don't disagree with that. And George W. Bush, he was born a millionaire into a dynastic family. Doesn't get it.
Silver spoon in his mouth.
Yeah. Or what was her name? Ann Richardson said of his father, born with a silver foot in his mouth. Yeah. 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 Good point, Beth. Good point. Thanks
Thank
a lot for
you.
The call. Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. This is really where the rubber meets the road. One of the core issues in America is the issue of fairness, the issue of reasonableness. What kind of society do we want to be living in? What kind of a world do we want to have for our children and our children's children? Ultimately, this is what it boils down to. And when you have a situation here where the largest employer in the United States has a very significant percentage of their employees, nobody is sure exactly, because they don't report it, they don't compile the information. This is why Ted Kennedy and John Corzine are trying to pass legislation to require states to compile this information. But Walmart, the largest employer in the United States, perhaps as many as half of their employees are on public assistance. should we be subsidizing these companies, or should we be simply saying, hey, it's you have to pay a reasonable, not just a minimum wage, a living wage? You know, the old-fashioned idea that Teddy Roosevelt, you heard that recording from 1913 in the last hour, Teddy Roosevelt saying, you know, a minimum wage, a living wage, rather. He introduced the phrase living wage into the lexicon. A living wage is enough to raise a family, put your kids through school, pay for your children's education, including college, pay for all of your medical expenses, have a vacation every year, and have a retirement. You know, have a pension or retirement funds are enough left over for retirement. We have historically had in the United States this essentially social contract that said, if you play the game by the rules, if you play by the rules, then you can get into the middle class. And that social contract, ever since Ronald Reagan came into power, has been steadily breaking down, ever since Reagan declared war on organized labor in the United States and on the working class in America. And then, you know, Bill Clinton making it even worse with NAFTA and GATT and on it goes. And George Bush Sr., of course, working for Fast Track Authority. George Bush Jr. pushing it even farther and now pushing for CAFTA. This is we are witnessing the absolute and utter destruction of the middle class of America. And I think it's just really important that we stand up and say, no, enough is enough. We would like our country back. Thank you very much. 20 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Happy 4th of July weekend, my friends. It is Friday the 1st, a long weekend coming up. It's Tom Hartman with you, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, the website if you want to drop by. Talk radio for the rest of us, exposing the con in conservative. A couple of other cases that Sandra Day O'Connor was the decisive vote on. Rush Prudential HMO versus Moran. This was a 2002 case that upheld state laws giving people the right to a second doctor's opinion if their HMO tries to deny them treatment. This is pretty basic stuff. A 5-4 decision. Had Sandra Day O'Connor been replaced by one of these corporate clones that call themselves conservatives, then you would not have, if you have an HMO, you would not have the right to get a second opinion if your doctor looks at you and says, well, I don't think you need any treatment. And we know how absolutely infallible doctors are, right? Hunt versus Cromartie, 2001. This affirmed the right of state legislators to take race into account to secure minority voting rights in redistricting. Again, the vestige of slavery, particularly in the South. Tennessee versus Lane, a 2004 case, upheld the constitutionality of Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act and required the courtrooms to be physically accessible to the disabled. This would have been shot down had it not been for Sandra Day O'Connor. Are you getting and we haven't even gotten yet to the Roe v. Wade stuff. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service with us with our daily report from Washington, D.C., from the belly of the beast. Hey, Victoria.
Well, yes, indeed. I mean, you know, we all thought it was going to be a quiet day. People were bringing their sandwiches, getting ready to rent videos, and then bang.
Yeah, Sandra Day O'Connor drops a bomb.
Sandra Day O'Connor drops a bomb, although, you know, the real money was on it being her rather than Rehnquist. Yeah. People in the know, certainly members
of 4 years ago, she said she wanted to resign.
Exactly, and everybody seems to have forgotten that.
Yeah, and in fact, she said, not only did she say, what was it, with Barbara Walters, that interview, was she said she wanted to resign, but she didn't want to resign under a Democratic president. This was
right
when Clinton was president. And everybody was wondering in the first year of the Bush presidency, why hasn't she resigned yet? And I think it's because she, you know, Bush came in and she figured out very quickly that he was not a Republican and he was not a conservative, that he was a right-wing ideologue, you know, way beyond anything of traditional Republicanism or traditional conservatism. And you know, George W. Bush makes Barry Goldwater look like a moderate, and Barry Goldwater was a fairly rational guy. And Sandra Day O'Connor, being from Arizona, you know, would have understood that quite well. So anyhow, you're tell us what's going on there.
Well, I mean, those who are still in town, obviously, in the Senate, we have Frist rushing to talk about it, and others rushing to talk about it. Really, it's punditry now in an accelerated form. People who thought they were going away for the weekend realized they're probably going to be doing the Sunday shows, and so everything has changed. Nobody has a clue in terms of who it's going to be. One word is that Gonzalez, who a lot of people said would be a great pick, is now apparently not the pick of those to the right of the conservative movement. They think he's probably too moderate.
Well, he hasn't come out against abortion.
Right, and they want somebody who's publicly against it.
That's right. That's what's got the Republicans who have hijacked Christianity concerned is that he hasn't come out against abortion.
So it's really going to be very interesting to see where this can go. Once somebody gets nominated, she obviously has said that she will continue to work until there's a replacement, and Bush has said that he isn't going to nominate anyone until he gets back from the G8 summit. It's one of those things where Washington will basically go insane trying to outguess itself, and I imagine that the White House decided some time ago who it is they wanted. And we know that they've spoken to some people. We just don't know who or in what detail.
Typically, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of a month or so, isn't it, after a resignation announcement until the White House puts forward a name?
Typically, kind of
the average?
Yes, typically. And they would probably, I don't know whether they'll gauge it right, but they're going to want to gauge, okay, you know, that we're going into the summer season, obviously, as you usually are when these things happen. Do we want to leave the whole of August for it to be talked about, or do we want to wait till September when we get back? I don't know the answer to that.
So we'll see.
Yes, that's basically where we are. We'll see.
Okay. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service, thank you so much. Our correspondent in Washington, D.C., I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. It's 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. You're in the real free speech zone. No barbed wire, no passes from the RNC required. Just good common sense.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Come all you good workers, good news to you I'll tell of how the good old union has come in here to dwell.
Which side are you going to be on, my friends?
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you?
And welcome back. 4.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. The place where being progressive never felt so good. Joe in Brookings, Oregon on the line. Hey, Joe, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Yeah, so I'd like to congratulate our senior senator from Oregon.
Gordon Smith?
No, isn't Ron Wyden?
Oh, Ron Wyden is the senior senator. Okay, yeah, I have not lived here long enough to have figured out which is more senior than the other. I'm sorry.
Okay, well, I'll help you learn the ropes anyway.
I appreciate it.
But yes, and Ron Wyden continuing his 9.5 years of useless and mediocre service to the people of the United States and the people of Oregon helped provide the margin of victory for CAPTA. Yesterday.
Well, it was more than a 5-vote victory, wasn't it? Wasn't it like 54-43 or something?
Yeah,
like
it was about 10 votes, and it was useless Democrats like him and Max Baucus and Dianne Feinstein. Useless Democrats like that who helped provide the...
And this is one of the reasons, I think, why so many people think that the Democratic Party doesn't stand for anything. I mean, you got Democrats who are in favor of eliminating the estate tax. You got Democrats who will not stand up and say to George Bush, we want an exit strategy from this insane war. You got Democrats who are voting for the energy bill that's just a giveaway to the oil companies. You got Democrats who are not standing up against the president on the bankruptcy bill. You got Democrats who voted to confirm chief liar Condoleezza Rice as Secretary of State. I mean, CAFTA, the list goes on and on. You're absolutely right, Joe. And people wonder what's wrong with the Democratic Party. Is that a lot of Democrats in the Democratic Party aren't behaving like Democrats?
Well, my congressman is Peter DeFazio, and I vote for him every 2 years.
He's a good man.
he's way too good for the Democratic Party, and I've had it in for the Democrats in Oregon ever since they decided to nominate Ron Wyden instead of Peter DeFazio.
Yeah.
But just a few words about the Supreme Court deal. I hope the Democrats weren't stupid enough to do themselves in too much on this whole deal with Sandra Day O'Connor when they made that deal about, well, we'll only filibuster under extraordinary circumstances. So nobody has explained to me exactly what that means and what exactly the extraordinary circumstances will be that that they'll have to use to block Bush on whatever crappy choice he makes for the Supreme Court.
It was another great cave-in, wasn't it, Joe? This is the Democratic Party. This is what you're seeing is the result of Bill Clinton creating the Democratic Leadership Council, or participating in the creation of the DLC, where they, you know, to their credit, they were trying to save the Democratic Party. They didn't know where they were going to find enough money to keep the thing going. So they look around and say, where's the money? Well, the money's with the corporations. So let's create a corporate-friendly arm to the Democratic Party, and that's the DLC. And what it did, Bill Clinton lost the House. He lost the Senate. It was a disaster for Democrats. The only guy who got reelected was Bill Clinton himself because he's charming and a brilliant politician. And it just has not worked well.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
They seek him here. They seek him there.
Oh, welcome back. Here he is, 27 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman, along with you. And along with our callers, our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Along with Louise screening the calls there, here we are back. We deserve to know the truth of the high cost of Walmart's greed, says Paul Blank, the campaign director for Wake Up Walmart. I want to get into that a little bit. Should you need welfare if you work for Walmart? What is the voice, the anonymous voice of America's unemployed? What's going on with Sandra Day O'Connor? Sandra Day O'Connor has been the swing vote in upholding a woman's right to choose abortion, on preserving the diversity of college campuses, on preserving representation for all in congressional redistricting, uphold civil liberties in time of war. I mean, this is serious stakes. 1-866-889-8894. Tony in Grand Rapids on the line. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I don't know if you already said this or not, but do you have a list of the senators who voted for CAPTCHA or not?
I don't right in front of me. I saw one this morning. Why?
I was just wondering if I could call them and tell them their disapproval.
Ah, okay. I it was either on the homepage of the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. Is a complete list of them. If you go to, I'm pretty sure it's NewYorkTimes.com, although it's probably all Sandra Day O'Connor all over there now. You might try Wall Street Journal, WSJ.com. One or the other of those I read this morning, and they had the list, and I pulled it up and looked at it, but frankly, I don't have it right in front of me right now.
All right.
I can tell you, by and large, it was the Republicans who were voting for it. That my recollection is that there were 13 Republicans who voted against it, and there was, although I may be wrong on that, and then there was a number of Democrats who voted in favor of it. I don't recall the exact number. I know that my senator here, Ron Wyden, voted in favor of it, the Democrat, here in Oregon, and my old senator, Jim Jeffords, the independent, once Republican in Vermont, voted in favor of CAPTCHA, which frankly surprised me and disappointed me. In both cases. So, but the simple thing that you can do if you're concerned about your local senator is simply call 1-877-SOB-USOB, which is the toll-free number of Congress, and it really is, 1-877-SOB-USOB, and just say, ask for your senator, give the name of your senator, and just give the name of your state if you're not even sure who your senators are, and ask for one of your two senators, and then just ask that senator, when you get their office on the line, did the senator vote for or against CAPTCHA, and then tell them what you think once you get the answer. So,
all right.
Tony, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Yep, I appreciate the call. I would be surprised if Carl Levin or Debbie Sabinow had voted in favor of CAPTCHA. I just noticed you were calling from Michigan. I would be really surprised if either of those two senators had voted in favor of it. I'm pretty sure that both of them voted against CAPTCHA. In fact, I can say with some certainty both of them voted against CAPTCHA. The past week, I was visiting, this last weekend I was in Michigan, I was visiting with my parents, and my father was telling me how proud he was that none of his sons, I'm one of four boys, none of his sons ever took welfare or handouts, that we've always worked. In fact, he was telling me the story of how my brother Stan, one of my brothers, had been laid off. He was eligible for unemployment. And he took a job that paid less than he would have made had he taken the unemployment check. And Dad asked him, why did you take that job? And Stan said, because I want to work. I'd rather be working and even make less than not working, than sitting around. And it's just, you know, it's, I guess, you know, I come from a family of serious work ethic. I my whole life, I've always, it seems, worked 50, 60-hour weeks. It's just, you know, it's just what you do. And it's certainly what my father did when we were all young. And you know, you can argue about, you know, those kinds of things and parenting and all that. But the point is that the majority of Americans, I believe, really do want to work. The majority of Americans think that holding a job is a good and important thing. And the majority of Americans, when they're working, believe that if you play by the rules, if you put in your 40 hours a week or more, that you should be able then to have a decent standard of living. You should have that decent life. I mean, this is not socialism. This is just very, very simple, very straightforward, saying, you know, if you work and play by the rules, then you should be able to earn a living wage. In fact, it was Teddy Roosevelt who first brought about the phrase a living wage. This is back in 1913. This is a recording that was actually made by Thomas Alva Edison. Thomas Edison personally made this recording of Teddy Roosevelt talking about the living wage. The first time that the phrase living wage was used, Theodore Roosevelt, Republican President of the United States.
We stand for a living wage. Wages are subnormal if they fail to provide a living for those who devote their time and energy to industrial occupation.
Then he talks about how living wage will vary from place to place around the country depending on local conditions, which is reasonable and appropriate.
The monetary equivalent of a living wage varies according to local conditions.
But there are some specifics, he says. There are some specifics that help define a living wage. 1913, Teddy Roosevelt, Republican president, defining, he wasn't president at the time, but he was defining, defining what a living wage is.
But must include enough to secure the elements of a normal standard of living.
A normal standard of living. What is that, Teddy Roosevelt?
A standard high enough to make morality possible.
High enough to make morality possible. In other words, you don't need to steal food to live. Oh, keep in mind, one of the main reasons that people were convicted of crimes in England and deported to the United States in the 1700s and then in the 1800s to Australia when we started refusing to take them. Remember, much of the state of Georgia was a penal colony for England. It's not, you know, most Americans are unaware of that, but certainly I lived in Georgia for a while. Most Georgians know it. And Australians are very conscious of the fact that their country was a penal colony. The main crime for which people were deported, stealing food. So Teddy Roosevelt says, number one, living wage, you can feed your family.
Provide for education and recreation.
Provide for education and recreation. You can put your kids through school, put your kids through college. You can take vacations.
To care for immature members of the family.
To care for immature members of the family, enough to raise your children.
To maintain the family during periods of sickness.
To maintain the family during periods of sickness. You can cover your cost of health care. You can take care of things if people are sick.
And to permit a reasonable saving for old age.
And to permit a reasonable saving for old age. In other words, you can retire. You can have a retirement. This is the middle class dream. And the middle class dream came about as the result of progressive legislation in the 1930s and 1940s by Franklin Roosevelt in large part and Harry Truman and to some extent Dwight Eisenhower as well and Jack Kennedy. This brought about the golden age of the American middle class. And then Ronald Reagan came along and said, you know, we're going to reverse that. All that stuff, that was a mistake. Those things that they did, the New Deal, that was a terrible thing. We don't want no stinking socialism here. That's what Reagan called it. Social Security, called Social Security socialism. Unemployment insurance, socialism. We don't want that. No, instead, we're going to go back to the conservative, he said. And see, I don't consider this conservative, frankly. I think that Teddy Roosevelt was a conservative. But he said, we're going to go back to these neoconservative notions of let the corporations rule and let the people rot, basically. And E.J. Montini is a writer for the Arizona Republic, a newspaper in Arizona. And he did a column about 2 years ago in which he talked about how he came home and found this. There was a message on his answering machine. And he put this on his website. He said, I wanted you to hear it. So here, this is the clip that E.J. Montini, you can find this on the Arizona Republic website on his, you can search on it. And this is that clip that he put up on the website. This woman who called his, the anonymous voice of the unemployed in America.
Voice call received 9:37 a.m. Tuesday, March 2nd. 2 minutes. To listen, press 0. I'm calling in and I'm promising myself not to cry, but y'all's right about things that are going on in the current events. I'm wondering, has anybody noticed in America, all of us that are unemployed? I'm 43 years old and I've been working since I was 16. My husband is 45. We've been married 22 years and we've always worked. A year ago I lost my job. 6 months ago his job was outsourced to India. We have three children, one that's 18, and we were going to try to help them get through college, but anyway, I just wonder, there's so many of us, and people don't seem to notice what's going on, and nobody, see, I read the paper, and I don't see a lot of people writing about it, and I know there's a lot of them out there, because I talk to my friends every day that I used to work with, and there are no jobs. And it just seems like somebody ought to write that a lot of jobs have gone overseas and there's no jobs in this country for people that have worked all their lives. And, I mean, yesterday I was on the phone looking around for shelters because we've got another 2 months before we're going to get thrown out of our house. And we were part of that middle class section there. This wasn't, I mean, I never thought this was supposed to happen to us. And I know there's a lot of people out there like us. So anyway, it'd be neat if somebody would write and make the country aware that, I feel like invisible. You go to the grocery store and it's like, see, we were an invisible section. But I think there's like millions of us. So anyway, somebody ought to write about it. And you always write about everything. And you make it good. And nobody hears us. So I... To respond or forward, press 1. To delete, press star D.
And EJ says he knew he couldn't delete that message, and he wanted to respond to it. And the response was the column that he wrote. It was a brilliant column. And that is the voice of America's unemployed. That is the voice of America, increasingly. I've lost my job. My husband's job has gone to India. I mean, this is the tragedy of Reaganomics and not just Ronald Reagan, and of the insane trade policies that Bill Clinton brought us by signing NAFTA and GATT. I mean, that crazy old coot Ross Perot with his big ears and his charts and graphs and pie charts, and he was right. He was right. And why the Democrats and the Republicans in Congress have not been able to wake up and see that and say, holy cow, what have we done to this country? Is beyond me. It's just completely beyond me. I don't get it. I'm completely baffled by it. And some of these policies actually are things that will probably end up before the Supreme Court. In fact, you know, should the United States surrender its sovereignty with these international trade agreements? In my opinion, no. You know, the one good lesson that George W. Bush Jr. taught us was that we don't need no stinking treaties. We can walk away. We walked away from the anti-ballistic missile treaty. We could walk away from NAFTA. We can walk away from GATT and the WTO. Why is it if the majority of the people in America don't want these things that Congress is voting for them? Because we have a broken system. Money and politics has corrupted our system, and several Supreme Court decisions like Boston versus Bilotti and Buckley versus Viejo, they have allowed corporate money into the political process to the point where it's absolutely out of control. And the average American is not represented any longer by either political party, frankly, although there is a strong movement within the Democratic Party to take back the Democratic Party by Democrats, by people on the ground. And I sure wish the Republican Party, you know, the Republicans would start talking about taking back the Republican Party. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Tom in Eureka, California on the line. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I talked to you a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about the lynching vote in the Senate, and I told you I was going to make some calls to that SOB number and, you know, find out about the 15 senators who didn't sign on to that that piece of legislation.
Right. It became 14 quite quickly. The one Democrat quickly signed on to it.
But, okay. Yeah. Now, the caller who just called about 15 minutes ago, who you told to call the SOB number to find out about how people voted on CAFTA, I'm putting the two together in that, okay, I got real busy with school, and I wasn't able to call anyone besides Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson. Now, the person who answered the phone contradicted what I read in the newspaper by saying, oh, she did sign on to that, that she was one of the co-sponsors, but the newspaper contradicted that. So I'm just thinking about, you know, that guy calling up to find out about CAFTA. And, I mean, when we call someone's office, are we lied to sometimes about how they vote on certain things?
Yeah. Well, Tom, it's entirely possible. It's entirely possible. I wouldn't put anything past them. Kala is calling from Iceland. Hey, Kala.
Hi.
Iceland.
Iceland? Yeah. You know Iceland?
Yeah. I'm sorry, we only have about a minute before we take a break, but I wanted to get your call in before we did take the break. What's on your mind?
Well, I was just listening to this unemployed lady there, and it's like horrifies me that all the jobs are going overseas.
Yeah.
And the hard working, you know, I experienced that because I used to live in Fall River, Massachusetts.
Uh-huh.
And we saw, like, the mills being shut down and going south, and then they went to Taiwan. And
so you left and went to Iceland?
No, I'm born here.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So I lived in the States.
Is Iceland having this kind of problem, or does Iceland protect its domestic industries?
Well, yeah, it's pretty, you know, solid as far as protecting. We have, like, you know, 2% unemployment, you know, which is really nothing.
Yeah, yeah, Louise and I have been there a couple of times, actually, but both Reykjavik and Keflavik.
Yeah, and, beautiful. Yeah, thank you. But, you
beautiful
know, I've been listening to you a lot, and I bought your book, What Would Jefferson Do? And my daughter lives in Massachusetts, and I'm, you know, trying to, you know, promote her consciousness as far as, you know, what's going on in the United States.
Well, good on you, Kala. And thank you so much for calling from Iceland and sharing your perspective with us. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, keep on going.
Okay, and you keep up the great work. Keep spreading the word there, and thanks for listening to us in Iceland. It's much appreciated. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People, the Tom Hartman radio program. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, the only independent member of the House of Representatives. Bernie.org, his website, our toll-free telephone number all across the United States, 1-866, toll-free, 866-889-8894. And Brian in Houston, Texas is on the line. Hey, Brian, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Great. I I have to admit I'm a little confused when it comes to the CAFTA. It seems like American corporations are continually going around the world looking for cheaper labor, but as you do that, you don't have anyone to buy your product. So if everybody if the labor is going overseas, eventually the market for the goods are going to dry up. So why aren't people going out and building economies? When China, we first started trading with China, Coca-Cola moved over there. You know, it's a big market for Coca-Cola. It's like there's no market if people aren't getting paid anything. Am I missing something? Why?
No, you're not, Brian. The only thing that you're missing is that you may be assuming that many of these corporations stay up nights worrying about what happens to the people in the United States of America. They don't. Their only goal and what all of these trade agreements are about is cheap labor.
Don't they understand that there won't be a market? I mean, if they keep doing that?
Well, that's not true. There's markets in other places in the world, and they're more concerned about what the next quarter will bear, what the next year will bear, what their compensation packages will bear, what their immediate profits will bear, than they are worried about 5 or 10 years down the line. Your question is, aren't they worried? Don't they understand that if the American economy continues to decline, the middle class continues to shrink, long term, it may not be good for them? These guys don't think long term.
And not only that, as at the same time that they're eviscerating the American middle class, they're helping to build an Indian middle class and a Chinese middle class, and they're thinking that those are the potential consumers, and we may see 10, 15, 20 years down the road where these, quote, American companies are all of a sudden no longer American companies.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the untold scandals, and it gets back to corporate control over the media, is the degree to which corporate America and people like the Bush administration have essentially sold out the United States and are far more concerned about corporate investments in China and corporate profits in China than they are about the needs of the American middle class. I mean, I was mentioning a moment ago the absolutely outrageous situation, which we at least temporarily stopped in the House, about building and transferring nuclear technology to China with American taxpayer loans. I mean, how in a million years can one justify that when small businesses all over this country that want to grow decent-paying jobs in America don't have any financial? We can't help them, but we can help a British-owned company build nuclear power plants in China. If you look at the record, and we have, and people should go to our congressional website, which is burning.house.gov. We have a lot of information on this. Corporation after corporation has made it very clear. These guys are not shy. Their future is in China. They love China. Bill Gates was talking about what a wonderful country China is, because in China, not only are wages low, not only do they have an endless supply of cheap labor the further you go inland, if workers try to form a union, they go to jail. If they stand up for their political rights, they go to jail. What better place to do business than in a country like that? And it is not just blue-collar jobs. Many of the people in technology will tell you that if we don't stop the transfer of information technology jobs, the outsourcing of those jobs to India and to China, they will become the heart and soul of information technology in 5, 10, or 15 years. So many of these corporate guys, along with this president, are selling out the American middle class, and people better understand that pretty soon.
Yeah, well, yeah, indeed. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Ken in Kentucky on the line. Ken, welcome. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hello again. Again, this is the best segment of your show. I wait every week for Friday to arrive for Bernie to be here. Listen, it's not. I've had arguments with friends over unions and price wars and whatnot. I've always said that when you pay give the baker a raise, the price of a loaf of bread goes up, and it's not such a bad idea to send jobs overseas to have the labor at a cheaper price. If we pass that savings along to the consumer here in America, which of course we're not, we're just lining the pockets of the corporations. They're making a higher profit for their own selves. And look at the oil companies as a perfect example. They have no care if the price of oil goes up to $60 a barrel because we're addicted on it, and they just pass that price.
And as you know, the profits of the major oil companies are very, very high.
Higher than they've ever been before. And I think that you guys ought to look into that. There's probably some collusion going on there. There's no reason for them to be making more money when oil goes up. They should make less money. We should spend the same.
Let me just say a word on and stay on, because when Tom and I talk about unfettered free trade and all that stuff, when we talk about high gas prices and what are going to be very high home heating oil prices, which impact states like mine in the wintertime, we should remember a couple of things. There is, as you know, an organization called OPEC, Overseas Petroleum Exporting Countries. By definition, the very reason for the existence of OPEC is to control oil production and manipulate prices. Some of us in Congress have demanded that the president go to the WTO and raise that issue. He has not done that.
Has OPEC dictated to our retailers the price that they have to sell gas for.
But OPEC works very, very closely, of course, with the large oil companies.
I know. Okay. Let's say the price of a barrel of oil was $40, and so fuel then was $1.30 a gallon.
Right. Right.
Now it's $60,
right,
and fuel is $3 a gallon. I don't think there's a direct correlation between that. I'd say let the oil corporations take a hit, make a little bit less money. They're still making
plenty of money. Well, in fact, Ken, the Wall Street Journal did a front-page story on this about a month ago in which they pointed out that the oil companies right now are making more profit on refining gasoline. They were making, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, when Bush first came into office, they were making, as I recall, it was something like 15, 20 cents a gallon in profit on refining. Now it's up to 70, 80 cents a gallon in profit on refining. So they're actually increasing their profit margin at the same, and then they blame the price of oil on it, and we're all just going, oh, gee.
That's exactly my argument.
Yeah.
They've got a formula. If it costs them $60, they charge $120
right
for the product,
no, that's
out
right
of it. Or whatever. Right. You know, and they can take a hit. It would be patriotic for them to do so.
But, you know, it is amazing on that issue, Ken, how little the Congress has done to stand up to them. Some of us, as I mentioned a moment ago, have demanded that the president start taking action against OPEC. The other thing that we can do immediately is start releasing some oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And the other thing, of course, that we can be doing is demanding that Detroit start producing automobiles that get good mileage per gallon, which will lower our dependence on foreign oil. But we're doing none of those things. And we're playing right into the hands of the oil companies and screwing the middle class.
Some incentives for research for alternative energy sources. We're so far behind, it's absolutely ridiculous.
So the issue there is actually we have made some progress in terms of the research. We can have cars that get 60, 70, 80 miles per gallon, but that is not what Detroit is interested in doing, nor is what the administration is interested in seeing happen.
We can have houses that produce more electricity than they
That's
use.
That's right. No, absolutely. We're sitting on the cusp of technology right now that could revolutionize energy and transportation in America, and we're not going forward. And that's a very, very sad thing.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for the call, Ken. I do appreciate it. By the way, Bernie, Ken said when a baker rises his salary, the price of bread goes up. What I think, you know, that's the core of the conservative argument against increasing the minimum wage, for example. What so many people fail to realize, though, is that labor is really a small percentage of the product,
right,
of the cost of most products. And so if the cost of labor, if people get an increase in the minimum wage, for example, or they start getting a decent salary, the price of bread is going to go up if the baker raises his price. But it's not going to go up anywhere near as much as his salary went up. He's going to have increased purchasing power. That's going to help the local economy. Every time we've seen the minimum wage increased, ever since the 30s when it was first put into place, every time it's increased, inflation has actually gone down. And the standard of living of Americans has increased.
Absolutely. You're putting money into the pockets of people who are going to spend it, who need it, who are going to go out and purchase products.
Yeah. Okay. Mike in Oregon is on the line. Hey, 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, by the way. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
No, it's an honor to be here, and it's an honor to talk to both you guys.
Thank you.
Question is, in the wake of the O'Connor resignation this morning, which is just a shocker, and also referencing the conversations that have just been going on, how do we not despair? And I know that activity is a thing, and I think focusing on the 06 midterms, perhaps with the House as a focus target. But nonetheless, the issues and the movements that you're talking about are generational movements. And all in all, I've been sweeping my jaw up off the floor so many times, I'm not sure it'll come up anymore.
Mike, for a start, for those of us who love our country and are concerned about our kids and grandchildren, despair is not an option.
Yes.
And the second thing is, if you look at how the American people feel about President Bush on issue after issue, and overall on him, this guy is one of the least popular presidents in the modern history of the United States of America. That's what all the polls tell us.
Mm-hmm.
You look at how people feel about him on Social Security,
mm-hmm,
on health care, on the economy, mm-hmm, on the war. In every one of these instances, the American people are catching on to this guy. And he and his friends are hanging on by their fingertips. And I got to tell you, being on the floor of the House a whole lot, our Republican friends are now beginning to get a little bit frayed as well. We're winning some good amendments. People are not going to the wall with George Bush. So now is not the time for despair. Now is the time to organize, to educate, and to fight back.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Good point, Bernie. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Freeman in San Diego on the line. Hey, Freeman, welcome to the program.
Hey, I wanted to say that this morning I called Senator Feinstein and Duke Cunningham and expressed my disapproval that Feinstein voted for CAFTA and asked that Duke not vote for it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the reason I called this morning was that your Baker comment about, you know, if they raise the price of labor, the loaf of bread goes up. I actually have to disagree with that. It seems like corporations set prices to what's going to maximize their profit and not necessarily, you know, based on their costs. Sure, they have to make money on it, but it's like, you know, Nike makes their shoes for a hell of a lot cheaper now in China, and they're
still
not going to lower their price.
They're still $100 shoes.
Right, they're not going to lower their price. So
yeah.
I think almost unless the cost is going to drive up, I mean, unless the cost is right up underneath their price, I don't think it has anything to do with how much they sell.
But Tom's point, I think it's the right one. It has some impact, but there are a dozen other factors which also impact the price of a product, and you've indicated that using Nike as a perfect example, it costs a few dollars to manufacture a sneaker in China, and they're selling it for $100 here. Certainly, labor is not a significant part of that.
No, it's helping Phil Knight become a billionaire. It's the same thing with the Walton family. $8 billion in profits last year. If they had taken only $7 billion in profits, they could have provided health care and a living wage to all of their employees all across the United States, and it wouldn't have increased one penny of prices at Walmart. So, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Jay in South Carolina. Hey, Jay.
Hey, how you doing, Tom? How you doing, Bernie?
Good, Jay.
A couple callers ago, when you were talking about the basically oil prices and stuff like that.
Yeah.
One of the things that been thinking about, especially since this last energy bill has been going through, instead of that $8 billion of incentives to the oil and coal companies, why not turn around and give that to the people to say, I don't know, put solar panels on their roofs?
That's an excellent idea. That is an excellent idea. And that is something that some of us are fighting for. The truth of the matter is that if you had municipalities all over this country and you had electric companies all over this country were providing incentives to have people put solar panels up, put more money into wind energy, that could have a huge impact, in my view, in breaking our dependence on Mideast oil.
You got to figure, hypothetically, if we say certain parts of the country, I'm in the southeast, the southwest, sunny parts of the country, every house puts a solar panel on, they take maybe 20% of their power that they're getting from the grid, and they're getting it from their panels, boy, that's a huge savings.
Yeah,
in places where it's windier, you put a big wind tower in your backyard, and if you don't have the sun, you use the wind. You know, and instead of these big solar fields that people keep talking, saying, oh, it'll take up all this land, and, you know, you need so many wind towers to, you know, put them in the backyard.
And, Jay, you know what? You're absolutely right. And the truth of the matter is the more solar powers that are produced, the cheaper we're going to be able to produce them. So if the government really got involved in this, we could lower the cost of the production of solar panels, get them out to the people, break our dependency on oil. Exactly one of the things that we've got to do.
Yeah, well said. And, in fact, Jimmy Carter tried to do that. Here's just 15 seconds of Jimmy Carter, Bernie. Well, maybe it's not. Hang on just a second. I thought I had it. Yeah.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
Ronald Reagan put an end to that immediately. It was one of the first things he put an end to when he came into office.
You know, and then you have, on top of that, you have the average gas mileage for vehicles in the United States today is lower than it was in 1987.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, in many ways, we're moving exactly the wrong direction.
Yep. Mike in Easton, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program.
Hi. I have a couple comments about, one is about the oil prices that the oil companies pay.
We have about a minute before we have to take a break, Mike.
Okay,
so
just be quick. But yep. They don't pay, they own the oil fields in a lot of cases or have long-term contracts. They don't pay $60 a barrel.
That's right. They're making a profit on those increased prices.
Yes, and in the past we had, when the last oil price increased, they had a tax on the windfall profit.
Right.
That's not, haven't heard anything about that.
Well, some of us have talked about it, but just. That ain't going to get past this Republican Congress.
You don't think so? windfall profits tax. Windfall profits taxes date back to the 19th century. I mean, this is not a new idea. It's been around for a long time. It's been done in many places in the United States. I mean, it was the initial response to the robber barons in many states. From the Republican Party in the 1870s, by the way.
But to answer, Mike, there is some legislation out there that would do that, but under the Republican leadership, that legislation's not going to go very far.
It's just going nowhere. Okay, it's Congressman Bernie Sanders. We're talking with our Brunch with Bernie segment. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. We'll be back with your calls and more with Congressman Bernie Sanders here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.